Hi everyone, I'm Matt with Innsbank.
And I'm Feeny. And today we're here with...
I'm Kerry Bringle, owner of the Peg Leg Poker Brands.
Okay, right when your phone rang, you were talking about you said you guys are expanding the bourbon into Florida, is that what you said?
We just expanded into Florida in the last 3 months. We're doing great down there. It's uh-huh. going gangbusters. So we've got a lot of support from our distributor, and we're in all of the ABC stores down there. So that's huge. They're a big organization, and mm-hmm. Then we just shipped our first shipment to Texas. So nice. We just picked up Texas as well, and we'll
Very
be in a good bit of the Specs stores down there, where they're the big player down there, but we'll be in restaurants and bars in both states, and so multiple other places that you'll be able to find us.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
So I'm originally from Boston, Massachusetts,
okay. yep.
just south of Boston. Feeny's originally from California. So
don't roll your eyes when you say that.
Did I?
Yeah.
I didn't even notice. There's muscle memory now at this point. So I am not well versed in the language of barbecue.
Okay.
And I know that, like, I have some friends that are like from the Texas area, and they're like, oh, Tennessee, but like they expect it to be barbecue like it's down in Texas.
No, very different.
So yeah, so give us the cliff notes about the like the different kinds of barbecue, like the way you do it, the way Texas does it.
Sure. So when I opened up Peg Leg Porker, one of the things that I was mindful of and I wanted to do was be a pure Tennessee barbecue restaurant. And so not trying to be everything to everybody, but really focus on what I grew up with and what Tennessee barbecue has traditionally been. And so in the state of Tennessee, that's traditionally been pork and chicken. And now you see a lot of barbecue restaurants offer everything and do kind of every kind of meat, or they might have a sauce from every region. We made a conscious decision to say, that's not us. If you want real Tennessee barbecue that's traditional to the state of Tennessee, that's what we do. And so that's just pork and chicken. And we do pulled pork, and we do a true West Tennessee dry rib. And then, you know, we'll do a half a chicken, which a yard bird. We do wings. And, you know, we've got traditional sausage cheese platter. Down in Texas, beef is king. And so brisket is their big staple. Now, they'll serve pulled pork, but it's typically brisket that they're doing. And then maybe some other meats, a lot of sausages, hot links. You know, it just depends on which region of Texas you're in and who is the barbecue restaurant. There's been more of an amalgamation of barbecue across the country where people are doing different things. But, you know, when I was growing up in the state of Tennessee, nobody was cooking brisket. You know, I never even saw one. It was they'd tell you two things, that's steak and go to Texas. And, you know, and I love brisket. And we do have a restaurant, Bringle Smoke and Oasis, that's a Texas-style place. And it's completely different menu than Peg Leg, completely different identity than Peg Leg. And so we wanted to keep that distinction by not saying, look, we're going to be everything to everybody. We wanted to say, look, we think what we do, we can do it better than anybody, you know, in town. And so that's what we're going to stick with and really be specialist at this. And there's a lot of great barbecue in this town. And there's a lot of great barbecue in Texas. Mm-hmm. It just depends on what your tastes are.
Yeah.
And usually that's what you grew up with.
Yeah. And you grew up here in Nashville, which is...
I was born and raised in Nashville. My family's all from West Tennessee. And so I traveled back and forth to Memphis to see family my entire life. My mom and dad grew up in Memphis. And so to me, that was... In Nashville at the time when I was growing up, we didn't have a lot of prominent barbecue places. It was really mainly... If people thought barbecue, they thought West Tennessee and Memphis. And that's changed now. You've seen a shift. There's some great pitmasters here in town that have opened up some dynamite restaurants. And so Memphis is still probably got more barbecue restaurants than Nashville. But
really?
But Nashville now has the quality of barbecue that Memphis has.
So when did you know or when did you think that restaurants and or restaurant industry and kind of food and hospitality? Like when in your was it cooking as a kid? Did you grow up in the kitchen? Did you grow up?
Well, I grew up cooking with different family members and enjoyed it. I cooked with my grandfather, probably starting at a young age, under 10, and then my uncle Bruce, who lived in Memphis, I started cooking with him some and learning how to cook barbecue. He competed in the very first Memphis and May World Barbecue Championship down in Memphis, and it was a hobby for him, and it had always been a hobby for me. My background is in healthcare and in technology, but I've always cooked barbecue my whole life, and then started competing in the world championship and cooked at Memphis in May for 31 years, and then now with the new contest down in Memphis called Smoke Slam. And so finally, I just I always thought that I might open a restaurant, but I thought it would be when I retired. And at age, I think 42 or 43, I was like, you know what? I think I want to do
so,
this.
So,
now.
What exactly with healthcare was it healthcare technology or technology something other than healthcare? Or?
I was in the clinical lab industry, so I was selling clinical laboratory services and testing to physicians, and so all your blood work, PCR test. All of that,
okay.
I was selling that service of testing. I worked for SmithKline Beecham, which was one of the larger labs in the world, and I enjoyed that. And it was good. I was in it for a while. I've always had businesses. I started working when I was 13, selling hot dogs at the Vanderbilt games, and then I've always worked and. And I had several businesses along the way. I started a t-shirt company in high school and sold those to fellow school members and to a local department store, and then did that throughout college, and just have always had something. Even if I was in corporate America, I had always had something that I would do on the side. Yeah. And I just was entrepreneurial in nature, and I had a next-door neighbor that was like a second father to me that taught me sales and really gave me a lot of life lessons about entrepreneurship. And then I went from healthcare into technology and enjoyed it as well. I was selling hosting services, and then I was a contact center specialist selling software, equipment, and professional services.
Was that all in Nashville as well?
My clinical lab career was actually in Memphis.
Okay.
So I moved down to Memphis and was down there for several years. While I was selling clinical laboratory services. And then I moved back to Nashville, started an online gourmet meat company with a buddy of mine.
Okay.
And we were one of the first ever on the internet in 1995.
No way.
And his family was in the beef business. And unfortunately, they didn't really have a stomach for the mail order business. And so we shut it down, but we probably should have kept it around. We didn't realize how early we were on the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then I went back into the clinical lab industry and then, finally made a switch to technology.
Wow.
So it seems like food was always kind of, you started like doing the hot dogs at Vanderbilt and so, family members big and cook. Seems like it was always like a little satellite just like kind of around you and then.
Yeah, I always liked to cook.
Yeah.
And then my wife took me down to Memphis while I was graduating from college or may have just graduated. I forget. And we went and her cousins had a team down in Memphis in May, and it was called the Rolling Wonder Pigs. And we went down there and visited and had a blast. Absolutely loved it. They were like, join the team, next year. Mm. Well, we got kicked out that year. So we had to sit out a year. And then I moved to Memphis. And then I joined the team. And we started a new team called Hog Wild. And we took second place in Shoulder 3 times. And then several top 10s. And then after about 12 years, I broke off and started my own team called the Peg Leg Porkers.
Wow.
And then I've had that business ever since.
It's fascinating.
So
I think the branding is just bat in a thousand.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm a marketing major. I understand branding, and you know, it's, I tell people that we're successful now because I've had many failures in the past.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So my dad used to say nothing ever is a complete failure if not to serve as a bad example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so as long as you learn from those failures, you can become a better business person and mm-hmm. A better leader.
Entrepreneurship at its finest. You got to have a lot of things that work and a lot of things that don't work to learn from. So.
Well, and you got to have a supportive family. You know, it's not an easy road. We've certainly had ups and downs. I've had good businesses and I've had bad businesses and I've had good business partners and I've had very, very bad business partners. And I've learned from every one of them and learned some hard lessons. But, you know, we're lucky that we have a successful a business right now.
Like who? Who is it? No, I'm just kidding. Feeny, tell them about the seltzer adventure.
Mine?
Yeah.
So I have an entrepreneur bone or two in my body.
Right.
And I did start a beverage company back in 2018. And I know you mentioned, you know, entrepreneurship is not for the faint of heart.
Yes.
You know, it's been ingrained in you from the beginning. But, you know, I noticed that when you started Peg Leg Porker, you also opened your spirits company at the same time. What possessed you to start two companies in one year?
Well, it wasn't so. Nothing possessed me to do it. I was a bourbon drinker. I had worked with Beam Global and now Beam Suntory for years as a sponsor on my barbecue team.
Okay,
I had a buddy that worked for them, and he got me the sponsorship, and I loved it and worked well with Beam. Big bourbon guy, always wanted to do something, either a collaboration with Beam or do my own label, but work with Beam. But they're just such a big global company that just was not going to happen.
Mm.
It every time you'd get an advocate, November would roll around and everybody'd be looking for, you know, scrambling on mm-hmm. who's going to be staying with the company or not. And so my buddy had left and was the vice president of sales here at a local distributor. And he called me up one day and he said, "Hey, man, I know you always wanted to start your own bourbon company. My boss just bought a batch. You know, they're going to start a brand. He kind of wants to hedge his bets a little. And so he wants to sell off part of this batch. And if you want to start your own brand, then now's the time." And I was like, "Nick, I just spent every penny I had. I don't have any money." And I went to my bank, and they were like, "Nah, you know, we're not going to loan you any more money." And so I called a fraternity brother who was a banker, and I said, "Hey, can you make this happen? I need $50,000." And he was like, I'll make it happen." And I got the loan, and so I started the spirits company, and I designed the label and everything, and we bottled. And that distributor picked it up because, you know, they had sold me the bourbon. So,
yeah.
and they loved the brand and they, you know, so it started to move and do well. And, the next batch I bought, I didn't want it to just be somebody else's bourbon. I wanted to make sure that it had my hand in it. And so I developed a process of, hickory charcoal filtering. So after the bourbon has aged and been barreled for 4 to 8 years, depending on the batch, when we dump it, we run it through hickory charcoal.
Hmm.
And so that gives it a finish and a flavor that's unique, that's done well without being smoky. Everybody mm-hmm. thought I was going to come out with a smoked bourbon, and I don't like smoked liquor drinks at all.
Okay.
I don't like smoked beers. I don't like smoked liquors. Mm. They're just, most people don't understand how to do it. Well, we work with smoke every day, so we understand how to use a subtle amount of smoke without something being bitter or
overdoing it. Yeah.
And overdoing
it. So did the choice to use hickory charcoal, do you use hickory charcoal
That's
with
what
the
we
food?
Use. Yes.
So it was like, one part opportunity, just one part smarts of your materials.
It was what we're familiar with. We understood it. We understood the nuances of it. And so that's what I did. And it turned out, you know, to do well. We won some awards, and then we expanded into more states. And, you know, we had New York wanted to pick us up as the next state. So we went into New York. We got a great distributor up there. In fact, he's coming in town tomorrow. I'm going to see he and his boss. And we kept on just slowly. You know, most of my peers in town that were doing distilleries were raising a bunch of money, you know, building out a distillery, making it a tourist sort of place. And, you know, their focus was on people coming in to the facility. My focus was we need to build the brand. Mm-hmm. We need to get distribution. We need to start stockpiling bourbon. And I didn't take on any investors, no backers, mm-hmm. nobody.
Which is rare for the alcohol industry.
It's very rare.
Yeah.
You know, so we... Actually, I had gone to my bank that I was banking with at the time and tried to teach them how to loan on bourbon. Their underwriters did not get it. They just couldn't grasp it. I said, this can't touch my current restaurant. It can't have anything to do with it, you know. And they brought me back a proposal that had everything tied together and collateralized. And I said, maybe you just didn't listen in our last meeting. I actually came to Innsbank and had a friend over here, and he understood it. He understood because he had an insurance company that insured bourbon warehouses. And so he knew that it was all bonded, that it was all protected, that I couldn't just go in a warehouse and move a barrel that, and as it aged, it got more valuable. Mm-hmm. And so, he was like, you know, this may be a good fit for us. And so I got a small line of credit, and then we flipped that and bought more and got a bigger line of credit and sold that and bought more. And mm-hmm. now we have a pretty large stockpile of bourbon. We started laying down our own about 5 years ago. And so whereas we bought aged product before, 5 years ago, we started laying down our own supply so that we were not as reliant on just trying to find something out in the market. All of our product is distilled and aged in Tennessee, with the exception of one product that we're going to release next year as our second edition Pitmaster Reserve, and it's a Canadian rye.
Gotcha.
But it's going to be double oaked on American oak. And now we've won. Last year we won World's Best Bourbon.
Congrats.
With our
get out of here.
Thank you. With our white label. We won best in class bourbon in Singapore World Spirits. And we won double gold in New York, double gold in San Francisco. We were top three in San Francisco. The Tasting Alliance, which is the most prestigious tasting organization for alcohol, then took the best in class from all three of those competitions and put us head to head. It was the first time they've ever done it, and now they're not doing it again. So it was the last time they've ever done it in a bracket style system, and we won World's Best Bourbon.
Wow.
With our lowest end bottle, with just our $45 bottle.
Wow.
Our white label. It's our 4 to 6 year old.
Wow.
This year we just won best in class in Singapore for our 8 year old bourbon.
Wow.
Fantastic.
And then we can't announce anything yet, but we've got another something coming up from New York Wine and Spirits, our World Spirits competition. We won about 16 or 18 medals this year. We did about the same last year. And so we've had a very successful two competition seasons with the bourbons.
We have a bottle here, actually.
Yeah.
Which one is that one?
Yeah, Chad had that.
This
in his
is a white label. That's what won World's Best Bourbon.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How cool.
You got to make a friend at SpaceX and get one on Mars.
There you go.
Like the universe.
There you go.
The universe's best bourbon.
There you go.
Yeah.
I like it.
Where do you go after World's Best Bourbon?
I like it. That's pretty awesome.
Well, and I think, you know, what we're proud of and that what I think is unique is that we won World's Best Bourbon and we're from Tennessee and not Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Whereas we're known for Tennessee whiskey in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. You know, Kentucky is the bourbon capital of the world, and we just beat them out.
I'm actually glad you mentioned that. So for anyone watching or listening that might not know the difference between whiskey and bourbon.
Yeah, so every bourbon is a whiskey, but not every whiskey is a bourbon. Bourbon has to meet certain specific requirements in order to be considered bourbon. It's got to be 51% corn. It's got to go into the cask at a certain proof and come out at a certain proof. Mm-hmm. It has to go into a new charred white oak barrel. And so bourbon can be, a lot of people will try and argue with me and say, well, bourbon can only be made in Kentucky. And I said, well, you absolutely don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, I'm from Kentucky. And I said, well, a lot of people from Kentucky think that. And I said, but bourbon can be made in any state in the United States. But it has to meet those specific requirements.
Right.
A whiskey can have a different mash bill. It can go into a used oak barrel. So very different requirements. But like, gotcha. I said, every bourbon is a whiskey, but not every whiskey is a bourbon.
Understood.
Kind of like a rectangle in a square.
Yeah.
That's where my brain goes anyway.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, that, I think that's a pretty good analogy.
So the growth of the bourbon company was happening while you had just opened the doors for Peg Leg Porker.
Yes.
So what did that look like? Were you, I'm imagining you're spread very thin at that moment.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I've got a great team. You know, when we opened the restaurant, I was probably at the restaurant for the first 2 to 3 years, every hour of every shift that we were open.
Wow.
I mean, it was, we took it seriously. We, I had spent all my money on this, and so I needed to make it work. It was tough. We had children that were in grade and high school. And, you know, my wife would have to, she, if we wanted to eat dinner together, she'd just bring them down to the restaurant and we would sit down at a table and she'd bring in food and we would eat right there for, to be together for dinner. They all worked in the restaurant. My daughter does again now. I have a son working for my spirits company, and then my middle child is I just helped him start a welding company.
Oh, wow.
So
it's pretty exciting.
I'm in business with all three of my children, and that's not it's not always easy.
Yes.
So, but it's, you know, we're lucky to have the opportunities that we've had because we've got a great team around us that that has worked very hard.
Is your wife also entrepreneurial as well?
She is not as much. She stayed home with the children. She has been extremely supportive. I couldn't have done it without her. Mm-hmm. That having that support at home and somebody who understands is not easy. It's hard on your family. It's a bumpy road.
Yeah. Mm.
And she now does have her own barbecue team called I Only Smoke When I Drink. And it's an all-girls barbecue team.
I love it.
And another home run with yes. branding.
Anyhow, it's been, she's really enjoyed it and has fun with it. And, you know, so she'll tell you how many times she's beat me. She beat me this last year at Smoke Slam and Whole Hog. And so by two places. And then she beat me one time before. So she'll tell you about that every time.
Nothing like a little friendly competition. Yeah.
100%.
I love it.
Do you think you'll ever bring any of her barbecue into the restaurant? A little wager.
Well, it's a, you know, she's cooking competition barbecue, and so it's a very different style of barbecue. Mm. You know, competitions are about the one bite and about, you know, packing it full as full of flavor as you can. You just don't, it's generally not something you want to eat a whole plate of most of the time. And that's just kind of the nature. When I first started, we were competing. We would cook what we would cook for our friends and family and throw it in the box and turn it in. And then we'd do an on-site presentation and we could, you know, razzle-dazzle the judges. And now there's a lot more competitors out there. People are doing a lot more things to it. And it's really a bastardization of barbecue if you come down to it. Not to say that it's not good or that those cooks – are not, or pit masters are not doing, can't cook dynamite barbecue. Some of them have it very down to a science, and they're very good at it. Mm. I was never like great, and I mean we've taken top three in the world in whole hog. I took Hog Wild. You know, we took second place three times, and I've won a lot of top tens, but it just never. I was never as fierce of a competitor in the competition barbecue, you know, world. And I didn't go do the whole circuit. I just mainly cooked it the one competition a year.
Gotcha.
Every once in a while we'd do three or four, but not often.
You're probably the marketing and sales in you was like, this one-off is a lot of work for just this one competition. Yes. You're probably thinking, if I'm guessing, you're probably thinking, how can I make this repeatable and sell more of it than just this one plate and maybe get a medal, maybe not.
Well, we like to say the trophy that we want is the green ribbon. So, you know, we want to feed the masses. Yeah. And so, you know, the biggest reward for us is that people line up. Mm-hmm. You know, to come and eat the barbecue on a daily
basis. I love that you guys do the jumbo wings.
Yeah.
Love the jumbo wings.
Yeah, it's the very, full wing.
Not that I've been everywhere, but I haven't seen that a lot.
You don't see it in Nashville much. You see it in Memphis a lot more.
Okay.
And so that was what I was trying to, you know, really replicate with those. We smoke them, and then we fry them, and then we toss them in our dry seasoning.
Oh, they're so good.
Make my mouth water.
Serve them with the white sauce.
Yeah, they're kick-ass. I tell everybody that's visiting from out of town or whatever. I was at Live Oak on Sunday because they're a Patriots bar. Mm-hmm. So trying to watch, I don't know if you're a football guy, but trying to watch your like local NFL team if you're somewhere else in the country.
Oh yeah,
they're making it impossible to like without spending a fortune. So Live Oak does a Patriots takeover. So I was up there, and a couple Boston guys were in town, and we're looking for some barbecue. Where are we? You know, and I'm like, over the bridge, go to Pegleg. So I sent them there.
Yeah, it's unfortunately on game day Sunday we're not open. That's the one day we're not open.
Oh,
I didn't know
that. Oh, bummer.
Yeah, Pegleg is not, but Bringles Smoking Oasis is. Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, Bringles is a cool vibe up there in the nation with it's more like a beer hall kind of beer garden type barbecue vibe. I like that. It's a cool spot.
On game day, whenever I don't feel like cooking, I have gone to Fat Belly East Nashville for their sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Oh, so good.
Yeah, so I'm a partner in Fat Belly, and it's Chef LaVon Wallace and his wife Kim. They do an amazing job. You know, he did his stints in the fine dining kitchen, and then, you know, he was kind of trying to find where he wanted to be and had young children. So he started making pretzels with his kids and just as something fun to do. And so, you know, he started posting pictures and people were like, can I buy some of those? And so they started selling them out of their driveway, and then they started doing farmers markets. And LaVon and I have been friends for a long time, and I watched his whole career, and a great guy and a great chef. And, you know, I could see that he was happier than he had been doing the fine dining and trying to chase that whole thing. And he started baking the bread and making sandwiches, and they finally decided they wanted to do a brick and mortar. And we were close, and I said, you know, I'm in if you want some help. And so we partnered, and they're doing an amazing job. Today they were named an eater as one of the top lunches. Mm-hmm. And so really happy to see the success over there. And it's just always a great meal.
Yeah.
I think that might be the one place of yours that I haven't been to yet.
Okay.
So Ben, remind me of the one in the airport.
That's Pig Star.
Yeah. I've been to that one.
Yeah.
And I think I've been everywhere else except for Fat Belly.
Yeah, it's good. If you like a good sandwich.
Make my mouth water.
Yeah.
I have a question about going back to the bourbon. When you started the bourbon, it was, you know, when you went to your sorority, your fraternity brother, who, if anybody's wondering if it's worth it to be in a fraternity,
there you go.
Seems like it might be situationally. But it was like opportunistic, right? It was like just kind of the right timing and things worked out. How much at that point did you know about that business? Did you feel confident, like, if I can get the money and if I can make this align, I can do it? Or did you have a lot to learn and dig into?
There's plenty to learn in the spirits business. So, you know, I had a decent general knowledge because of my friend Nick and our friendship and working with Beam and my close ties to the Beam crew. So I had seen a lot of the inner workings and understood it. You know, a lot of people will go into that business and they think, oh, you know, me and my Uncle Billy, we make moonshine and everybody tells us it's awesome. And I mean, same with barbecue. It happens in both worlds. And they're like, you know, so now I'm going to do it. And it's, you know, I tell people in the restaurant business, you have no business owning a restaurant if you can't understand how to run a business. It's a business.
Yep.
You know, we're manufacturing food. And, you know, people say, well, food is the most important thing. Well, you know, yes and no, because people expect the food to be good. They're giving you money for it. Mm-hmm. So that's their general expectation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If they're blown away, that's dynamite, but they expect it to be good. Mm-hmm. But if you can't run the business, then, you know, you're going to fail. And same with the liquor business. A lot of the people, you know, would get into it thinking, I got this, and me and my uncle and our family thinks it's great. Well, there's a million brands out there. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a real brand and a real story and something that's compelling for people to want to be a part of, then one, you're not going to get distribution. And two, you know, you're not going to get people to notice it and buy it on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And distribution is everything. Just like the wholesale food business out there, distribution is everything. And people don't get that sometimes when they go into it. They think, because I think it's cool, the distributor's going to want to pick it up. Well, when the distributor's getting hit with 20 new bourbons a week, mm-hmm. and they have to choose which one is worth their time and energy and which one's going to sell, then
right.
you may be left on the sidelines if you don't have that. And then this generation is very attuned to authentic stories versus manufactured mm-hmm. stories. And, you know, so that resonates with this generation. They can see right through it. And when somebody is not being truthful about the origins of their product or this, they're not mm-hmm. buying it. Mm-hmm. They'll flatly reject it, and then they'll probably embarrass you. And so, luckily, I have an authentic story. I literally am the peg leg porker. And it's a compelling story for people because I overcame an obstacle of pediatric bone cancer when I was 17. And so, that has resonated with our customers, not just on the barbecue side, but also on the bourbon side. And, you know, I try and be myself. I'm very frank and I'm very straightforward, and I just kind of tell people like it is. I guess I'm old enough to not care as much anymore and what comes out of my mouth. And that has worked well for us and our brands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, it doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I've
you're
certainly
right.
had to have my wife temper me many times.
People can definitely smell a sale, yeah. you know, yeah. and authentic stories are king. And, you know, that's part of the reason why we shoot these the way that we do is yeah. just press record and just go. And if you end yeah. up talking about football, you end up talking about
yeah.
football.
You no,
know,
yeah.
If you don't, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, one of the things we want folks to be able to come away with is people that are successful in business, but not just because they're like cutthroat, right? Or like ruthless or, you know, like anything like that. You know, obviously most successful business folks are smart in one way or another, but, you know, Innsbank does a really good job of, you know, partnering with authentic folks who are not only business savvy, but, you know, for lack of a better term, aren't full of shit.
Yeah.
Good people too.
No, yeah. It's, I mean, I agree with that approach. It's, You can tell that authenticity when you talk to somebody. When I've done bourbon tastings with people, you know, you'll get these folks and, you know, you get barbecue and bourbon have a very similar audience. Mm. You get fanatics that are just like, you know, I'm the expert. I know, you know, and, you know, you got to put up with a lot of that. And depending on how you take it, you know, I would tell somebody if they say, you know, they want to start talking to me about the technicalities of the bourbon or the mouthfeel and what notes am I supposed to taste? And I said, look, your mouth is your mouth and mine is mine. They're going to taste things differently. Mm-hmm. You either like it or you don't, you know, it's, yeah. But I don't want to, if you want to sit around and talk technical with somebody about like that, that's not me. Mm-hmm. If you want to sit around and have a drink, I'll tell you some fun ass stories that we, you know, that I've done and we've had fun with, then we'll have a great night.
Yeah.
But it didn't go, I'm not Mr.
Right.
Technical Chemist over here. That's not, right. I got a guy who does that. He's great.
Right.
You know, that's what he's good at.
Yeah.
I've told like these tasting groups that say, well, you know, you put this out. Why didn't you put it out at a higher proof? And I said, well, you got to understand, it's a business. I got a choice. I could get a premium for a higher age, or I can get a premium for a higher proof. But I don't necessarily get a double premium. Mm. So do I want to give you something for free, or do I want to get the most bang for my buck mm-hmm. out of both those products and release them separately? Mm-hmm. And they were shocked that I said that, because they were like, wow, what do you, I mean, did you just tell us that? And I was like, well, I mean, I'm just being honest. It's a business, just like anything. Yeah. It's, mm-hmm. you know. People say, well, how should I drink it? And I said, well, any way you want. You bought the bottle.
It's with your mouth. Now.
Yeah, with your mouth. That's right. And, I mean, you know, usually every afternoon I have what we call a pork and stormy, which is peg leg porker, bourbon, and ginger beer.
That's awesome.
And that's my daily drinker. And, you know, I like it on the rocks. I don't like it neat. It burns my throat too much. It just... Mm-hmm. I get heartburn, and but everybody's got their own
yeah.
way they like it. Most master distillers mixed with ginger ale or with different things, and didn't just drink bourbon straight up
mm-hmm.
yeah. most of the time.
Fascinating. Yeah. I saw that you have a book called Barbecuing for Dummies.
Yeah, yes, I do.
And I noticed that you said a lot of it has to do with patience.
It does. Yeah. Barbecue's not rocket science.
Yeah.
It's about time and temperature.
Yeah.
And having the patience to do it. And so, you know, Barbecue for Dummies, it was a Wiley Brothers, the Four Dummies franchise. A buddy of mine was running that and asked me if I would write Barbecue for Dummies. They had never done one. And I told him I would. It's not my life story. It's not the Kerry Bringle origin story or anything. It is... a practical guide to being able to make great barbecue. It's a reference book that you can pull off the shelf, go to a chapter, go, I'm cooking this, and it's going to show you exactly how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you got the time right and you've got the temperature right and you have the patience to wait till it's done, then you can make great barbecue. Anybody can.
I feel like that applies to a lot more than just barbecue, though. I feel like that applies to entrepreneurship, probably your bourbon business.
It does. Yeah, it's a lot. You know, in the bourbon business, again, like I said, instead of going and getting investor money and boom, building a mm-hmm. distillery, we said we're going to build a bottling plant when we need to, when we've got the volume to where it behooves us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Same with a distillery. You know, hey, we'll build a – I can contract distill right now, and that's what we do. But when the time comes that we have mm-hmm. such volume that it makes sense for us to do it ourselves, mm-hmm. well, that's when we'll do it ourselves.
Sure.
And so I went a very different route than most of my local peers. And we just – you know, I like to say, hey, turtle wins the race. You know, we're in this mm-hmm. for the long haul, and so we're not we're not trying to go top line, top line, top line, flip the company and make a bunch of money. That'd be nice if somebody wants to buy it, then, you know, they can come talk to me. But I wanted to build a business that even if we never sold it, it was going to make money and it was going to be sustainable long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that that's what we've done.
Definitely.
So for future generations of Bringles, have you guys talked about who's going to have to take the chop to stay on brand? Is
that's
that
right. That's right.
It's like if you want to take over someday,
yeah. yeah.
bite on this wooden spoon.
Yeah, exactly. We used to say that's how the team started. Is that we drank, we got around, got to drinking one night, and decided our name was going to be the Peg Leg Porkers, and I'm the one that went first, and everybody else chickened out. So right. You know,
yeah, if all your friends chopped their leg off to start a restaurant business, would you?
There you go. Exactly.
Too late.
Yeah. So I don't know. You know, I told the kids that this was my dream and it doesn't have to be theirs. And so they could choose what they want to do with their life. I'm happy to have them working with me. But if it's not their cup of tea, then it's not their cup of tea. So it just
sounds like you've passed on the entrepreneurship mindset, though.
I've tried.
Yeah.
You know, it's you wonder sometimes whether they have the right mentality to carry through with it. And you know, it's really about grit and the ability to get completely smacked down and have everything taken from you and still want to get up and do it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some people, you know, don't. And some people, you know, some people do. And they may be gluttons for punishment. But, you know, it's almost something that's in your soul that you just say, I can't. You know, and when I had a big letdown and lost a bunch of money, you know, my wife looked at me and she said, you know, it's time to go get a corporate gig. And so I did. And I did it for 10 years while I built up my base again and my confidence again. And I still started another company while I was doing that, but I did it on the side, nights and weekends, and, you know, turned it into a successful healthcare company that then I sold out to my partner with it and got out. So.
Yeah. And one of the things I love about, aside from the food and the branding and everything, you guys do t-shirts, you do hats, you do branding and stuff, right? Yeah. That's a big thing, you know, with breweries and distilleries, all that kind of stuff around Nashville is like when someone does branding really well.
The recognition
like,
is.
Yeah, there. Like they'll move it and you'll see the stuff out around town. If you're a local, like you see people wearing stuff and, and I mean, you had that t-shirt business, right? So we're starting to see the full picture of like all the things that you were kind of naturally into and then the things that you got good at over time. And they all just kind of swirled together into this like final form of what you have now.
It's been great. You know, some people get branding and some do not. And, in my mind and, in my world, brand is everything. And if you don't have a brand, then it doesn't compel people. There's a difference between having a company and having a brand that's recognizable. I love it when friends or family send me pictures of somebody they come across wearing a Peg Leg shirt in Spain or in Australia
that's awesome.
Or in Japan or in California. It's great. And then, you know, I had a buddy send me this last weekend, bottles on the shelf in Florida, you know, and
cool.
They send me bottles. I had my buddy Adam from Gumbo Brothers was over in the UK and walked in. He may have been in Dublin. He walked into a bar and looked up on the shelf and there's a bottle of Peg Leg Porker.
That's pretty cool.
And so, you know, he was just like, wow, this is the bar I walked into and here it is.
Yeah.
And so that's really cool. There's some people that really do branding well in town, but there's not a huge group. And, you know, I think we do branding well. One of the reasons I invested in Fat Belly is because I think that they nailed the brand and the look and the vibe and the feel. Mm-hmm. It's an experience. You go in there and it's funky beats and good eats, you know, and they got cool music playing. And, you know, and with Peg Leg, it was... most of the barbecue places in town were Barnwood and Tin and country music. And I had grown up with Memphis barbecue where it was blues and soul and cinder block and concrete. And so I was very intentional when I opened Peg Leg on the building that I wanted to be cinder block, no windows. I wanted to be concrete floor. And, you know, it was very, very deliberate on the feel that I wanted people to have when they walked in. And, you know, Daddy's Dog, Sean does an amazing job at branding. You know, he gets it. And so you know, there's some other brands in town, but those are ones that stand out to me as being, you know, compelling brands that people go, oh,
right,
I know that logo. I've seen that shirt. You know, he does funny videos, or that's he's cool, you know.
Yeah, Yeehaw and Old Smokey move a ton of merchandise.
Oh, yeah.
They get that big store inside with all the hats and the shirts and everything. They move a ton of stuff.
It's a brand rather than an experience, rather than just a company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They also have that huge building, too. Which,
you know. They're at 6th and 6th and Peabody.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
That's a big space in there.
It is.
Cram that thing full of hats. And
yeah.
Yes.
They had a Traeger grill in there one point.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think it was a Yeehaw Traeger grill or an Old Smokey Traeger, like, stamped grill or something.
Yeah.
It was like, put the logo on anything, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, you can.
Yeah, once the logo is recognizable, you can really do anything with it.
You could do a lot. Yeah. We've signed a deal, and we are about to have our sauces and rubs distributed nationally.
Hell yeah.
And so we had a very large company come to us because of the brand. Mm-hmm. The president came to me and said, hey, I love everything about what you're doing. I love everything about your brand. I love your marketing. It's compelling. And, you know, if you ever want to do anything, let me know. And I said, I'll let you know right now. Yes, I do. Yeah. I didn't want to try and learn that business from scratch. It's a brutal business. The grocery store game is not an easy one. Mm-hmm. And so, being able to walk in the room with a 900-pound gorilla is really a good thing. Mm-hmm. Going into a business that's as low margin and as sort of cutthroat as that. Several big brands own the space. And if you're not one of them, it's a very steep, steep uphill climb. Mm-hmm. And I've had to learn enough industries already. I don't...
I was going to say, you got your fingers
on learn. I didn't want to learn that one from scratch.
Yeah.
If there was another industry or space that's sort of connected to like a personal passion of yours, something you grew up with, whatever, maybe not necessarily something that's realistically on the horizon, but just hypothetically, if there was something that like that'd be really cool to get into, what would it be for you?
You know, I always wanted to have a clothing company. Mm-hmm. At one point, I wanted to do a brewery and brew pub. Mm-hmm. Not as much anymore. That space is getting a haircut, you know, and is a tough space as well these days. You know, I don't know. I just like a lot of things. No, I mean, we did a collaboration with Nissan and made a Pitmaster Titan, and that was fun. Cool. We went out and did it at the SEMA show, and it's a cool truck.
Yeah.
I love it. You know, that was fun. And, you know, but I don't know. Yeah. I'll see something. And I was friends with Kimmins Wilson, who was the founder of Holiday Inn. He basically invented the hotel chain. Oh. And he was going to motor lodges with his kids, and every one of them was different. And so he was compelled to say, you know, what would be cool is if there was a brand that was consistent, all across the country.
Yeah.
And all along my trip, I could go stay in that and know that they're going to be the same. And Kimmins was he wrote a book called Half Luck and Half Brains. Mm-hmm. And he had his 20 tips for success. And one of them was opportunity is all around us. And I may get it a little slightly wrong, but as long as you have a trained eye to see it, as long as you have a trained hand to grab it, and as long as you got a trained mind to use it. I mean, there is opportunity everywhere. Mm-hmm. And if you have that entrepreneurial mindset and you are able to notice that opportunity, and I think a lot of that comes with age, with experience, with mistakes, with, you know, everything, you'll start to see more and more opportunity around you. And go, you know what, that's an opportunity. But people that say there's no more opportunities or there's no room for entrepreneurs are, I mean, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. It's That's everywhere. Insane. It's,
they already have their minds shut off to even look for that opportunity.
They do. Yeah. They do. And you got to be open. You just have to be open to go, mm-hmm. hey, if it's a good opportunity, it's a good opportunity.
Yeah.
And I'm still sort of old school business in the fact that, I mean, you know, you got a lot of internet companies out there. They did the whole .com and that whole model of lose, 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 burn through money, burn through cash, but it's a great idea, and then somebody's going to scoop us up and buy us, and we're all going to get rich. I still look at business and go, you got to make money. If it doesn't make a profit, something's wrong. You just,
right.
I mean, there may be these bumps with the internet and with new technologies to where people make a bunch of money, but if they never made a profit, was it really a successful business, right. or were they just burning through investors' yeah. cash? Until, you know, right. something broke loose.
Like your friend said, one part luck, one part opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're just banking on the luck part, just yeah. waiting to get lucky yeah. for somebody else to also think your idea. But then again, that's the person that has, like you said, the trained eye to spot it, the trained arm to reach it, and the trained mind to use it.
Yeah.
You know, so if you don't have one of those three things, you got to find someone who does. And only banking on that lucky part, that's a dicey game.
You'll be waiting a long time.
That's a yeah. I mean, maybe you won't. That's how luck works, but you yeah. probably will. Yeah. I yeah. think a lot of us are, you know, we're used to consuming so quickly, and we're used to we're all moving so fast. You know, everybody's about optimization. You know, how much more can I get done? Mm. How much faster and more efficient can I get it done? But I think a big part of identifying opportunity is paying attention to like your individual self as a consumer and a user. Because oftentimes, like the problems that we all have with something that's lacking in a particular industry, whether it's a phone app or whether it's a ladder that, you know, there's no ladder that does this one thing that I always need it to do, but it never does. Like, you know, pay attention to how you use stuff. And like you said, that's the trained eye part. Mm-hmm. Like being able to have your eye really open and not be too fast and too consumed with what you're doing. Like, you got to have that eye to identify opportunity.
Well, you do, and you got to, you know, and the opportunity, you know, for the restaurant business, when people come, and I've mentored a lot of young restaurateurs wanting to get into the business, and, you know, they'll say, well, what's the biggest piece of advice? And I said, you know, if you want to live with the classes, you feed the masses. If you want to live with the masses, you feed the classes. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of fine dining chefs that are broke mm-hmm. Because it's a very different type of restaurant to run.
Yep.
And you got a lot of food cost and a lot of food waste because, you know, we have a very simple menu. It's got mm-hmm. very few proteins, you know, very few, 6 sides. A lot of them use the same ingredients. We have very little food waste because mm-hmm. we're able to cross use those ingredients, and so we don't have much spoilage. And you know, if you're feeding everybody, I mean, there's a reason Walmart's the Walton family have so much money. I mean, they're feeding and clothing everybody,
mm-hmm.
and not just the top echelon,
right.
And that's where a lot of times people get it wrong. They want that prestige, but they don't know how to make mm-hmm. a profit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people like to quote the CEO of, I think it was Ferrari, and they said, why don't you ever do any advertising? And he said, our market's not watching television.
Nope, they're not. They're not.
They seem to have, you know, they're at that end of the bell curve where they seem to have figured out how to appeal to the classes.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And you know, you look at LVMT or whatever, that they have all the different high-end brands.
Oh, yeah.
And they, you know, they understand that niche and mm-hmm. that market, you know, and they know that they've got a consumer that will pay $30,000 for a bag that costs them $500 to make.
Yeah.
But it's the brand.
Right.
It's a compelling brand, you know, and so they can sell a Birkin purse for whatever.
For a car.
For a car, exactly.
I had a friend this past weekend went to a new, like, kind of cocktail, like, bar-type place, and very kind of, like, upscale kind of loungy vibe. And, you know, those kind of businesses are turning over and opening and closing so much in Nashville. And, you know, sent me a picture. She's like, oh, it's really cool in here. And I had a weird, I remember having a strange thought when she sent me a picture. It was like, what do people find cool about bars and lounges and restaurants? Is the service good?
It's new and shiny.
And is the lighting cool?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, is the decor cool and is the lighting cool? And, you know, me being a nerd for all this stuff, like, lighting's a big part of what I do. And you'd be surprised at how many places just have cool lighting.
Oh, yeah.
And people are like, I love that bar. And it's like,
but that's why they don't stick around, though, because they don't have the story behind the brand, I think, as far as, you know.
Yeah, some of them, I mean, what we're seeing now in the restaurant marketplace in Nashville is, one, too many restaurants are coming in town. It's flooding the market. We're getting a lot of L.A., Chicago, New York places coming in. Some of them are very good, but some of them make the assumption that Nashville doesn't already have great food. We have some great restaurants here. And so we already have some really great food. A lot of them have big money behind them. So they're not the independent. They're the, you know, they've got a hospitality group that's behind them, or they've got investment bankers behind them. They come in, they spend a bunch of money. They, you know, will have to, they're forced to pay more for labor because, you know, it's a tighter market now. They'll pay big wages, and then, you know, they won't make what they thought they were going to do. They didn't set the world on fire like they did in L.A. or New York, and then they'll, you know, start to sort of fall apart. In the meantime, they've kind of wrecked the market. They've wrecked the pricing for the per square foot. They've wrecked the labor market. And folks like us that are independents suffer from that at some extent. And, you know, I don't know how a lot of them do it, because they're paying the rents in Nashville now for some of the restaurant spaces are
absurd.
Absurd. Yeah. And then the property taxes now are absurd. And you know, people think, well, if, you know, that renter, he doesn't have to worry about the property taxes. Yes, he does, because typically he's got a triple net lease. And so he's responsible for those taxes. And like, my property taxes have gone from $9,900 or $9,500 when I first bought my building to now $75,000.
In how long?
In an 11-year period.
Wow.
God damn.
And they're about to probably raise taxes again, you know. And so, you know, that hurts. When they proposed the 34% property tax increase, I wrote a big op-ed piece to the mayor and to the city council, basically saying, look, you're about to lose a lot of independent businesses. And my prediction came true. We lost a lot of old Nashville staples that were historic places that just got so beaten down, not just with the property tax, but in the middle of COVID, that they closed their shops. I also have to compel people that want to go into the restaurant business, or really just about any business. If you can buy your real estate, then do it. And a lot of people think they can't afford it. And they just make the assumption, I can't afford to buy that. And they're wrong a lot of the time. Because if you look at the rents, it's like, wow, you could buy a building for that. You know, you may have to look at a little bit different location. But owning the real estate is a very good hedge on the business side. Because if the business goes under and you've dumped, I mean, some of these restaurants are dumping, you know, 2, 3, 4, 10, 15 million into buildings that they don't own.
Yeah.
And
real estate always appreciates.
That's a losing case. It just, and so we own Bringles. We own Peg Leg. We own our blending and bottling facility. And those have been great investments. And, you know, and where there's a will, there's a way. When I started the restaurant, I spent every last dime. I had an investor initially that was a silent partner. And the building was for sale. And I looked at him and I said, we need to buy this building. And I said, I don't have any money to put down. But if you'll put down the 20%, then over the next 5 years, I will pay you back my half of that 20%. And once we have our mortgage, I will make every payment. That will be the rent. And so you'll never pay another dime other than this initial 20%. You're going to recoup half of that, and we'll own the building 50-50. And he said, okay. And he had the free cash to do it. And so even though I didn't have any money to put into it, we made it work. Mm-hmm. We dumped the money into the build out of the restaurant. We did it very reasonably priced. I had people tell me, you're not going to be able to build it out for that. And I said, watch me. I'm pretty cheap and I'll get it done. We just need to get open. And then once we make some money, we can always upgrade our equipment. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. But as soon as we finished that build out, we went back to the bank, refied. With that refi, I got a cash out to give him his 50% back. So within 8 months, he had his 50% back.
Wow.
Of the 20% deposit. And he owned half this building now. And I bought him before I did my expansion at Peg Leg. We added 9,000 square feet to a 3,200 square foot building at Peg Leg. And before we did that, I went to him and I said, I'm going to buy you out of your house. And I had already bought him out of the restaurant. Within the first 6 months we were in business, I bought him out of his restaurant share. And I said, I'm going to buy you out. We went through it. It had appreciated significantly. He made about a 1,200% return on his investment.
That's it.
And so in a 4.5 year period. And so we both walked away from that feeling really good about it.
Yeah.
And so when people say, I can't, I'd say you're just not being open-minded enough to how you could do it. And when I talked about the entrepreneur who lived next door to me, that was like a second father that taught me a lot about that. He always told me that, hey, that you can always find a way. He said, you can buy whatever house you want in Nashville, Kerry. And I said, no, I can't. The bank won't give me a loan on a, you know, $600,000 house. And this is, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And he said, somebody will. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be interest rates are at 7% right now. It may be at 15%. Mm-hmm. But somebody will give you the money.
Right.
You just got to be creative enough and you got to go out and find it. And so if I'd have, you know, listened to the initial bankers before I came to Innsbank, I wouldn't have been able to find anybody to loan me on the bourbon. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have had a line of credit to then start building up my stock. And so I found a bank and a banker that was open-minded enough and was able to take that chance. I made it work. And, you know, then Innsbank started a practice of loaning on bourbon. They started working with several bourbon companies.
I think we're when we're recording this, we're about to start running some ads soon about
whiskey,
about the appreciation, you know, of a business account with Innsbank. It appreciates over time, just like whiskey, and we underwrite that too.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yes, thank you
for real.
And thank you, and thanks the bank. So I think that people sometimes tend to paint themselves into a box. And when you do that, you really are shutting off a lot of the opportunity that's out there.
You hear no once and you think, oh, I'm just going to give up. You need to hear a couple no's before you realize, okay, this is what's going to work and what's not going to work. And where there's a will, there's a way.
I found, so I had three banks turn me down about the restaurant. I found this silent partner who owned a successful business in a totally different industry. He saw the branding. I showed him everything. He loved it. He said, I'm in. We bought the building, and then the bank wouldn't give us the money to build out the restaurant when they knew we had bought the building to build out the restaurant and had told me all along it's probably not going to, it shouldn't be a problem. Then they denied that loan. Hmm. And I was like, well, this sucks. Hmm. We literally built it out on an American Express card.
Wow.
And so we did that and we made it work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we got it open and then we were able to get the mortgage because then the building was worth a lot more.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we refinanced, which paid off all of that, all of that debt.
That reminds me of the guys from Pathway Lending, who we had them on here too to chat. And, you know, they, a big thing with them is if somebody comes through their doors with an opportunity or an idea or something, and it's not quite fully there.
Yeah.
He said, these people are used to walking through the doors and they don't necessarily know what they're doing all of the time. You know, when you said that the eye, the hand, and the mind, like they might have two out of three or one out of three. And what they do is they don't say no, they say not yet.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, internal resources where they'll help educate people. You could pay for, you know, I'm not sure if courses or curriculum is the right word, but they have programs that help. Anyway, you said a word that's really important and in there, and it was creativity.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people equate creativity to artistic ability. They kind of use those as synonyms, but they're not. They're not the same. And you know, having your background in sales and in marketing, you know, creativity is huge in sales.
Sure.
You know, if you only have the tools that you think you have, you're limiting yourself to only those tools. But if you can think creatively, and you know, a lot of people say like, I'm not creative. And it's like, you might be creative.
Yeah.
You know, it just might not manifest in a way that's like
familiar
oil
to you.
Paintings, you know, or like, you know, or like video on the internet or something like that.
100%.
Creativity is I think
how you utilize what you can, you know.
It's an undervalued, you know, principle and practice, I think, is creativity. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how you would practice being creative, but I think it's important that people try to practice to be creative, whether it's puzzles or like, I don't know, anything.
Well, you need to be able to take a different look or a different mm-hmm. perspective mm-hmm. on things,
yeah,
and not see everything as black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And the truthful thing is that most of the time, everybody going with the crowd over here is not the creative,
mm-hmm. yeah,
and they're just going along with what they've been taught or what they've been told their whole life, and they just never had somebody say, you know, there's other ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you can solve that. Now, I was lucky. My father was a mechanical engineer and he was able to think very much outside the box. And because mm-hmm. of it, he was a very successful mechanical engineer because he could go on a job site where people were like, we don't know what we're going to do. And he could go, have you thought about this?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm lucky that I had people in my life that told me that at a young age.
Yeah. Great mentors, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And I think just your exposure to all those different industries gave you all those different lenses to be able to look at
a
problem and come up with a solution. Truly fascinating.
It was it's all been an experience.
So what's next for Peg Leg Porker and, you know, the brands that you've built?
Well, the next thing is our sauces and rubs, which we just went and called on Walmart and we're calling on all the big major chains, and so hopefully, by the end of 2025, we'll be in a lot of grocery stores and stores out there. And we're expanding the bourbon company. And we are, now that we have our blending and bottling facility and tasting room, we're able to go at our own pace rather than relying on somebody else
mm-hmm.
to bottle for us and holding us up. And that's been great. And so we'll really focus on that. We've always said with Peg Leg, there's only going to be one Peg Leg Porker restaurant. We like to say we're building a legacy, not a chain. And that's why all of our different concepts are all completely mm-hmm. separate brands and entities.
Yeah.
So
only one leg.
That's right.
Of the restaurant.
That's right. That's
very on brand.
That's right.
100%. Can't have two legs.
That's right.
This was a lot of fun. Really appreciate you bringing your varied expertise and experience and share some stories about mentors and everything. I think it's insightful and I think it's helpful.
Well, thank you both. I appreciate you having me on today, and I appreciate the relationship that we have with InSpec.
Yeah,
I know we do too. And anytime you need somebody to try sauces or whatever,
sauces, bourbon, you know, call us.
No,
a little sauce fairy, just leave one on the doorstep, and we'll go through it.
Absolutely.
Thanks for watching, everyone. We'll see you next time.